You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
My name is Beth Ferris, and as Maria said this morning, I work on internal displacement issues, and it's been a joy to work in preparing this conference, and even better to be here and hear the variety of perspectives. Hope you all enjoyed this morning's session. We've got two other panels this afternoon that will build on what we discussed this morning. But now over our lunch break, we're delighted to have with us Nancy Lindborg, who's the Assistant Administrator for Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance at USAID. And those of you who follow the news, and I know everyone in this room follows the news, knows how full her plate is these days between Syria and Mali and hundreds of crises that never make it to the headlines. Nancy has worked with USAID in this position since 2010. And before that, worked for almost 15 years with Mercy Corps, where she was a real leader in the international humanitarian community, often raising the issues around resilience, human rights, response, preparedness, talking with groups like this, with people and governments, and with many of those affected by disasters. Nancy, we're glad you're here. She'll speak for 15 or 20 minutes, and then we'll take questions. So be thinking of your questions as you continue to enjoy your lunch. Thanks, Nancy.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's great to be here. And Beth, thank you so much for the introduction, for all the work that you do here at this project, and for organizing us today. And also thanks to the Center for Northeast Asia Asian Policy Studies. I feel like there's the spirit of Madame Ogata hovering over the room. When I first arrived in Washington in 1996, one of the very first things that I came to was actually here in Brookings. It may have been this room, an event organized by Brookings and Madame Ogata to look at how to close this gap between relief and development. That just underscores, I think, how long we have all been working on these issues of how to prevent, how to respond, how to recover, how to connect to our development activities. So it's a great pleasure to be here with all of you today. And I know there are a lot of folks in this room who have put much time, much energy, and have a lot of expertise on disaster risk reduction issues. So it's an honor to be here with everyone today. And I had the great privilege of traveling to Japan last fall for the World Bank Sendai Dialogue. And this was on the margins of the World Bank meetings that were happening in Tokyo. But we gathered in advance up in Sendai to talk specifically about disaster risk reduction. And our Japanese hosts put together because of the setting, it was far from an academic exercise, but we were very much in the heart of still the raw aftermath of the very devastating, triple impact of the tsunami, the earthquake, and Fukushima. And, we had an opportunity to meet with high school students and local officials, and they shared their stories. I don't know, some of you may have been at that event as well. And I remember I was particularly moved by one of the local Sendai officials who, in a spirit of great sharing, noted in one of the discussions that, in fact, in their preparedness, and Japan is one of the most prepared nations, I think, in the planet. But he said in their particular community, they had really forgotten or had not appropriately brought in women in the preparedness conversations. And so as a result, after the disaster hit, they had not fully prepared to meet the needs of women because women hadn't been in the dialogue up front. And, it only underscores for me that in a country that has that level of capacity and such a great attention to preparedness, it underscores the challenges of getting this right in the many countries around the world that have far less capacity and far less abilities. And it was also, I thought a wonderful reminder for all of us in the spirit of sharing that was brought forth. And then 2 to 3 weeks later, of course, we had Hurricane Sandy hit the east coast of the United States. And I think that kind of 1-2 punch really brought home the fact that, this is truly a shared global enterprise of grappling with disaster preparedness and disaster risk mitigation. And suddenly resilience, at least here in this country, has become very much a household word that you see in the newspapers. And, we in the relief and development world often get inside a little bit of our internal world of acronyms and words. And so I actually find it extraordinarily powerful and reassuring that the word resilience has entered the general vocabulary. And I think that's a testimony to the power and the importance of working with that word as we think about what it is that we're all trying to do. And it also, that Hurricane Sandy, what happened in Sendai, underscores that this is in fact a global problem and that weather extremes are becoming the new normal as we look at the impacts of climate change. And you move from the devastation that happened in Japan and in the East Coast of the United States. And I know that for many people in this room, you don't have to imagine because it's what we spend a lot of our times doing, thinking about the results of that extreme kind of event in a country that doesn't have a FEMA or the government capacity. There isn't a social safety net system. There's no insurance. And so this is truly the challenge as we look at the drumbeat of increased disasters and greater costs. And, when we look at the impacts of this and the fact that only 9% of disasters over the past 30 years have occurred in low-income countries, but they had 48% of the fatalities. It really underscores the challenge that we have, especially knowing that it's women and children that suffer the most, and we're seeing increased displacement as a result of climate related disasters. The estimates wildly vary. Beth, you may know better, but the data that I see is about 10 to 40,000 people per year are displaced because of disaster. So this begins to outline the challenge for us. And so I'd like to really look at four key issues. And the first is that, we simply cannot afford to not get ahead of these disasters. We cannot, through the costs in human suffering or pure economic terms, continue to not address these disasters with greater preparedness. Secondly, we absolutely cannot afford to have this happen outside of our development efforts. We need to seize this opportunity to create a more comprehensive whole of looking at these issues. Thirdly, we really, with 2015 upon us, need to grab the opportunity to take some of the critical elements related to climate change adaptation, disaster risk reduction, resilience, and make sure that gets into the post-2015 agenda as we look at post-Hyogo, post-MDGs. And finally, I want to say a few words about how at the heart of all of this is democratic, inclusive, and accountable governments. And that's really where we're going to get the kind of gains that we need. So first of all, just looking at the costs, I'm sure everybody in this room has seen a lot of the same data that I have, and that is, the trends are going up. We're seeing a faster pace of natural disasters. In the Asia and the Pacific, the number of disasters has really spiked in the past four decades. From 93 to 2012, it doubled relative to the previous 20 years. And we're seeing worldwide the damages from disasters are 15 times higher than they were in the 1950s. And this is, of course, not only because of the rising disasters, but increased populations, increased concentrations of folks. But the cost of these trends are hitting not only our developed economies, but they are really, really taking the toll on our development efforts. In Kenya, as a result of the 2011 drought, in addition to the $1 billion that just the United States put into that drought response in 2011 and 2012, that drought cost the Kenyan economy $12.2 billion. So these costs are not sustainable as we look ahead. In Thailand, in those floods in 2011, 13.6 million people were affected and about $40 million of damages in Thailand. We've seen $500 billion of economic damages in the last decade in the Asia and Pacific region, where, of course, you've got a concentration of the world's hydromet disasters. So we basically I don't think there's any opportunity to walk away from this as a development challenge, because it's undermining the gains that we make with our development approaches. And at the World Bank last month, there was a panel on resilience, and I sat next to the finance minister from Peru, who made the comment that, you know, Peru, as a newly emerging middle-income country, is one disaster away from being a lower-income country again. And this is something that he really grapples with as he thinks about the preparedness in his country. He also made the interesting note, and I would just flag it, that he previously was the deputy finance minister, and it's only by happy circumstance that he's now the finance minister, that he has that continuity of perspective on what it takes to be thinking about disaster risk reduction and preparedness. And it speaks to how quickly we all transition and how often we lose some of the good work that has gone on. And in the face of all of that increased trends of disasters, increasing costs, increased fatalities, donors still are only spending about 3.6% of our disaster-related assistance on preparedness, compared to 70% for emergency response. And this isn't even getting into, because I don't have those statistics, of how much of our development budgets collectively, globally, we spend on disaster risk reduction. And I think I don't have those statistics because it's probably very small. So that leads me to, okay, what do we need to do about this? I believe that we have, and Beth and I were just chatting about this at lunch, we really have an enormous opportunity right now. We have a convergence of interests and a convergence of opportunity to bring these issues of risk, of how to manage risk, how to better prepare for it, and bring it more fully into the development agenda and look at how we bring these streams together. We have done a lot of good work on disaster risk reduction and I know that a lot of people here in this room have been a big part of that. At USAID, through our Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, and I think you'll hear from my wonderful colleague James Fleming, who may be in the room, on one of the panels later today. James has been a big part of that. The OFDA team has, through the years, put a lot of energy and emphasis on disaster risk reduction and worked on increasing early warning systems, helping to prepare first responders, working to set up national disaster management authorities with various governments. And I think we've had a lot of big progress. And you know, after the deadly tsunami in Indonesia in 2004, a lot of investment went into creating better preparedness and better early warning systems. And so when there was the April 2012 earthquake of 8.6 off the coast of Sumatra, we saw the immediate impact of having that warning immediately available. People knew to go to higher ground. And we saw hundreds of thousands of residents take action that saved their lives or would have saved their lives had that, in fact, resulted in a more deadly tsunami. So we know that a lot of this work is making a difference. And we know that we can do more of that. We also see the opportunity to connect that with our development work. USAID has put forward a global climate change policy in the last 12 months. We released our first ever resilience policy, and we are about to release a new disaster risk reduction strategy. And we really see these all of a piece. And we see the word resilience as an opportunity to put out there a shared goal for both our relief and our development activities. And in our policy, and I commend you to look at it, I'm sure everyone has a copy, but it's on our website, and it really builds on the lessons and the activities and what we've learned from our good DRR work, our global climate change adaptation. We acknowledge the opportunity to build food security and also the need to always remember governance. And so we are seeing Through that work and the way in which we've connected that to our development partners and worked in support of country plans, that this really provides some wonderful momentum that we need to continue to keep focused on well past the disasters and move it forward. We were galvanized in particular by the droughts in the Horn of Africa in 2011, followed by the droughts in the Sahel. We're seeing these coming at an ever faster pace. The cycles that used to be 10 years are now every 3 years. So we have joined, put together joint planning cells that bring together our relief and our development teams to do a joint analysis of what are the problems that we need to solve and to bring into the development planning the thinking that you've got to be addressing the vulnerabilities, because if you don't address the vulnerabilities, we will see a roll back of all of the good gains that we've had in our development work. We had a, and some of you have heard us talk about this, but in the, as the drought took hold in Kenya, we saw, we mapped where had the U.S. put our investments. And we saw that year after year, we were pouring significant money into the dry lands in the Northeast, and all of our development money was in the productive South. And so we've changed that and instead brought our teams together and come up with a plan that integrates, it layers, and it sequences our relief and our development funding so that we don't lose the good work that's done, whether it's the disaster risk reduction or it's a response. We don't lose that basis that we can pull it forward with our development funding. And we're seeing this happening with many of our donor colleagues as well, and being picked up by our government, governments like Kenya, like Ethiopia. We're now working in Niger and Burkina Faso to do the same thing, and we're looking ahead this year at focusing on Asia. We've particularly identified Nepal, Southeast Asia, to look at bringing this method of working within AID, this resilience approach, into our development strategies so that this doesn't remain in the province of just the humanitarian community. And we see this as one of the most important ways forward. The challenge is that we all stay focused on it. I invite all of you to help be a part of maintaining that focus and holding us collectively accountability for doing that. Going forward, you know, in his State of the Union address this year, President Obama talked about the commitment to eliminating extreme poverty worldwide in the next two decades. And I would submit that the only way we can do this is by understanding this issue of addressing vulnerabilities and understanding that our development is pulled back, undermined, if we aren't thinking about preparedness, we aren't thinking about managing the risks, and we aren't thinking about how to get the most vulnerable communities out of these chronic cycles of poverty. We have this opportunity, as I mentioned, about as the Hyogo framework and the MDGs come to a close, to think about how to embed some of these critical concepts of vulnerability, of preparedness into those frameworks. We don't have the luxury of thinking of the SDGs and the MDGs as addressing totally different issues, especially when you look at the connections of the impacts of increased climate change, increased disasters, and how that keeps people in poverty. I want to just say one word about urban context, because we're seeing, especially in Asia, where you've got the emergence of so many of the global megacities, coupled with I think it's 60% of the world's hydromet disasters, we have got to be thinking about putting additional focus on how to address DRR and resilience in an urban context. I would note that USAID has circulated, and it's the first time we've done it this way, so I hope people are engaged with us, a new policy, draft policy on working in urban environments, and this is very much a part of that policy as well. And we usually cook the policy and then share it. This time we're sharing it for comments, so we invite you to comment and then use everybody's collective good wisdom to make sure we have the strongest policy possible. But, you know, we've already done a fair amount of work in urban areas with our DRR. James may talk more about it in places like Kathmandu, where we're very, very concerned about the possibilities of earthquake. We've worked at the community level and the local governance level to try to strengthen how buildings are built and awareness of having to have more earthquake-proof homes and schools, et cetera. But so much more work needs to be done and at such a higher scale. This will take the concerted efforts of the donor community and of the countries where these mega cities are emerging. I also want to just note, and I think you'll be talking about this as well, the importance of pulling in the private sector, that we see a huge role for the private sector. It's in their interest, obviously, to ensure that communities and countries aren't over and over again devastated by natural disasters. Again, through our OFTA team, we are currently looking for public-private proposals for disaster risk reduction programs in Burma, Thailand, and Vietnam, and we really see this as a way to bring those emerging private sectors into being a part of the solution. So let me just close with something that is, you know, I feel like I've got the great privilege. I think my phone is about to ring there. I've got the great privilege to have a bureau within USAID that brings democracy, conflict, and humanitarian assistance together. And this is really an acknowledgement of how all these forces work together, and that when you don't have accountable democratic governments, you are far more susceptible to the ravages of natural disaster impacts and less likely to be able to manage conflict. Conflict will always be there. It's how you manage it. And so as we drive forward with this agenda, you know, and we are looking at half of the world's poorest in 2015 will reside in fragile states like Nigeria, the DRC, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal. It is imperative that we think about the relationship between these disasters and the lack of governments and the lack of accountable governments to address that, and the extent to which these fragile states are also more prone to conflict, and the fact that no conflict-affected state is on the pathway to reach the Millennium Development Goals. So we have set up for ourselves the challenge of bringing the resilience agenda and coupling that with those countries that are the most fragile, the Yemens, the Somalias, the Nepals, and looking at how we can bring the best tools and programming approaches from our DRR portfolio, from our global climate change portfolio, and couple that with what we know about mitigating and managing conflict and helping to promote more accountable democratic governance. The convergence of these factors creates an overlapping problem set that we need to be thinking about how they all work together. And, you know, the fundamental potential that I see with the resilience approach is overcoming some of the stovepipes that keep us from doing better work. I see this very keenly within USAID, and I know that a lot of institutions grapple with this. It's inevitable at one point, but I'm confident that the urgency of these issues is helping to propel us to think differently about how we do this work and how we can bring together the best of a lot of different parts of our global efforts to tackle these problems over the next decade. This year has this extraordinary momentum. I think the conversation today is a part of that, and that there's a great opportunity for us to take this forward. So I commend the conversations that are happening today, and I look forward to hearing what other great ideas this very expert group has come up with. Thanks so much.
you so much, Nancy. We have time now for some questions. I believe there's somebody with a microphone. Yes, there is. But maybe to get things started, I could pick up where you left off on this resilience concept. I mean, what does resilience offer that disaster risk reduction, local coping strategies, what does it offer that's new that would bring humanitarians and development actors together?
So the way that we're thinking about it at AID is you know, we're defining resilience as, you know, really looking at from the household to the community to the national to the regional level, that you enable these actors and systems to have the ability to withstand shocks. We've added in our definition not just withstand shocks, but to stay on a pathway to greater development and growth. What we've seen with a lot of the excellent work that happens through our humanitarian action, where I think the humanitarian community over the last decade has made remarkable progress in how not just to save lives, but how to include disaster risk reduction and build resilience. But we're seeing that it's not connecting up to our development approaches, and so it's necessarily limited, because a lot of times the programs are short term, they end. We see often they end and then there's a pause that keeps going before the development programs come on stream, or they may come on stream in a very different place and not build on all of that momentum. So the resilience agenda is an opportunity to bring that together and to think about how the household relates to the system or to the regional level, how the marketplaces that operate regionally have impact on the ability of a pastoralist to be more resilient, for example. Currently already has, James, you can correct me, but a little over 10% of its budget is dedicated to disaster risk reduction. And I'm very, very proud of the fact that we have that much invested in disaster risk reduction. And I will say it's not enough. It's not enough because it can't be a humanitarian-only enterprise, and we can't afford not to get ahead of these disasters.
Okay, we have time for questions until about a half an hour, or a little bit longer. Yeah. Yes, this woman over here. And if you could please introduce yourself, and if you could stand up so we can all see you.
Hi, Keely Maxwell, a Philaeus Fellow at the EPA. My question is, there are a lot of criteria and indices out there for measuring development and development progress. So when you're talking about incorporating resilience, how are you going to measure progress and resilience, both from a humanitarian perspective and from a development perspective?
Well, that's an easy question for you, Nancy.
Yeah. First of all, I want to give a shout out to the AAAS program. I've learned about this when I entered government. And it's, at AID, we've become avid consumers. It's a way to bring social scientists into the government in a way that helps us be smarter. So, I commend you for your being in that program. This is the critical issue. And, it is, as if you look at our policy, we make it very clear that the resilience policy is a starting point for a continued effort on how to implement it in a way that is smarter, better, and monitored. It's a conversation that we're having as part of the larger partnerships that we're involved with. In the Horn of Africa, we are the secretariat for a group of donors called the Global Alliance for Drought Resilience in the Horn. And we have collectively funded a technical group that is connected with the intergovernmental, it's IGAD, I always forget the acronym,
Authority.
Intergovernmental Authority for Development, which is an African regional platform for action. This technical group is working with all of the governments and with the donors to develop common criteria that will enable us to measure success and progress. There's also a group called the Political Champions for Resilience that meets twice or three times a year, and that's top of that agenda as well. What we've all agreed on is that it cannot be measured only by humanitarian criteria. It has to have a development dimension to it as well. And there's a lot of thinking and work that has been done that I won't go into, but it is still very much a work in progress.
Any other questions? Yes, up here.
Hi, my name is...
Oh, wait for the microphone, wait for the microphone, if it's working.
Hi, my name is Nancy Ngo. I'm from Synergy International Systems. My company is a company that built the database for the recovery Achenia for the tsunami 2004, and also coordinated some of the management information systems for the Maldives, Sri Lanka, and Thailand. My question is, in reference to your comment about the importance of the private sector in disaster relief, DRR. In your opinion, what exactly can the private sector provide that other organizations may not be as competitive in? Like, can you be more specific on like how you see the private sector playing a role in DRR increasingly?
Well, let me take that in two pieces. The first is that you know. One of our observations is that the private sector mobilizes often in a very wonderful and generous way after a disaster hits. Mm-hmm. And, we've increasingly seen corporations moving in significant amounts of supplies or donations. And wouldn't it be great if we could harness that upstream so that instead of just being, you know, as is our challenge as donors overall, but instead of just doing the response, they were able to understand that in these areas of historic risk, if you get ahead of it, then there's a self-interest for them of not having markets as disrupted or populations as affected by helping to do investments, particularly in urban environments, in improved infrastructure or better early warning systems. I mean, we're seeing in a lot of urban environments just clearing out the gutters or having better sewage systems can have a huge impact on mitigating flooding potential. So enlisting them in a way that is both in their business interest as well as from a preparedness and a risk management perspective. Secondly, there's clearly a specific role for the whole world of insurance, and some of the insurance businesses have been very, very forward-leaning on this, and you know there's a lot of good work happening on insurance at all levels, from sovereign risk down to household risk insurance. And then finally, I think that there's a role for the private sector in helping to innovate a whole variety of solutions. And we're seeing this not just for disaster risk reduction, but across the development spectrum that, you know, bringing in civil society, bringing in business is critical for ensuring that we're creatively thinking of the best solutions and also for scaling and distributing ideas and good solutions.
Okay, other questions, comments? Maybe we'll take two in a row, this gentleman here and then the woman behind. Yes?
Yeah.
I'm Fred Kringgold from Virginia Tech, and tying a few things together, what we've seen today is that disaster risk reduction and climate change adaptation both depend a great deal on exposure of built environment, and particularly, as you mentioned, urban issues and concentration of population. It seems that regulation of construction and land use are fairly fundamental to any hope for risk reduction. Mm-hmm. Does AID envision taking any kind of active role in supporting the development of regulatory capacity, maybe innovative, technically assistance-based regulatory capacity in disaster-prone urban areas?
Good question. And the woman behind? Yes. Alice, sorry.
Yes, it's Alice Thomas from Refugees International. Speaking about resilience and DRR, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about funding streams. And I was happy to hear you say that we actually have 10% of our budget goes to DRR.
Off to budget.
Off to budget. I'm still surprised to hear that because of the reports I've looked at in the past, it's been a much smaller amount. I'm wondering, you know, in the many, many years, Nancy, that you've worked on this issue, the problem is that the way that we're within OFTA competes, humanitarian response dollars compete against DRR investments. What is your idea of a better model of this going forward, and how can we convince appropriators to appropriate money for this?
Okay, both great questions. Let me take the funding one first. What we've done in the inaugural year of our resilience policy in both the Horn and the Sahel is that we pushed very hard for the development of a joint plan that was the result of our humanitarian, our development, multi-sector development folks sitting together and identifying what is the problem that we're trying to solve and come up with a plan that really took a more comprehensive view of how to manage the risk, what are the risks that we're that we need to be paying attention to, and where are the opportunities. It sounds kind of fundamental, but that's not what was happening. And what we've learned is we can do far more creative blending of our resources. And as I mentioned, integrating, layering, and sequencing so that we have our OFTA or our Food for Peace emergency funds connected up with or sequenced with our development money. And so I do not advocate for a new resilience pipeline because I think creating a new stovepipe is not a good solution, but rather use this as an opportunity for looking at how, depending on the situation, it's going to look really different in Vietnam than it will in the Horn of Africa, about what pipes you need to bring forward. But in the Sahel, we've done the same thing in terms of the importance that that health plays in the Sahel and the importance of our agricultural investments. So I think it's about being smarter in terms of bringing all those together. They are not resources that have ever in the past been tagged as DRR or resilience, but it's understanding that all of those pipes are important for feeding into a solution set. That's, to me, the beauty of the word resilience, is that it takes us out of the three-letter acronyms that we all live in and no one understands if you're not a part of that world, and it creates a vision of the possible that we're aiming towards. We have a lot more ability with our funds than we sometimes understand to do good work. On the land use and regulations, and by the way, it's also elongating some of the work that we do with our emergency funds and trying to speed up some of the work mm-hmm. that we do with our development and bringing a little bit of a shared tempo to both sides and doing so in a way that doesn't compromise that really important, fast, emergency, life-saving response that we absolutely must protect. And then the final point on that is that we tie down huge amounts of our OFTA budget year after year in the same crisis that never goes away and it never gets better, year after year. And what we basically are doing is we're treating chronic poverty with our humanitarian money. And it's chronic poverty where people are buffeted by a constant set of shocks and they can never get above it. And so that's a development problem. That's why we have to bring the development actors to be fully focused on the most vulnerable communities. And the Kenya example really, really underscores that. That was a set of shocks in the most vulnerable parts of the country. And even if you don't care about that marginalized population, it still had a $12 billion impact on the Kenyan economy. So if you're not moved by the moral argument, we got an economic one for you. On the other question about land use and regulations, you know, yes, absolutely. It's something that through our democracy, rights, and governance program, we're very focused on looking at how to help governments create these greater regulations. But more importantly, because as I'm sure you're well aware, like Kathmandu has fantastic laws. It's the implementation. And part of what we've looked at is helping to set up things like disaster management authorities, often which have this dimension to it of bringing forward the application of some really good laws, including environmental laws. You know, the former Soviet Union had fantastic environmental laws, all of which were egregiously ignored. But you're absolutely right. Those are fundamental to the solution set.
Nancy, as we look for other questions, I really don't know the answer to this. I come from a humanitarian background, and I don't really understand the opposition or the difficulty of some in the development community not to jump on board with DRR. I mean, what's holding that back from being accepted as part of a mainstream development response?
Well, I think we are, you know, not to be overly optimistic, but I think, you know, you don't do this work if you're not kind of inherently a little bit optimistic. But I think that two responses. First is, I think that that opposition has been is dropping, and that there is a new appreciation broadly for how important it is to understand the vulnerabilities and the risks, and to include that analysis in your development in your development strategies. The World Bank, and in Sendai last fall, committed that within the next 5 years, every single one of their development strategies will include a risk analysis, which is huge. And it's, you know, this is what we're doing with our resilience agenda, is ensuring that our development portfolios are fully looking at the risks and the vulnerabilities. I think historically the resistance has been, if you've got scarce development dollars, and I mean at the heart of all of this is that there hasn't been enough development dollars, you know, globally ever. But if you have to make trade-offs, do you invest in the areas where you're going to get high productive results, right? So you invest in the part of the country, say, let's take Kenya, for example, in the productive south, where you're going to really get economic returns and, you know, stoke an economic engine that can drive the full country forward. The problem is, A, it's often not inclusive development, and we know longer term how that can lead to conflict and, you know, pockets of communities who are completely outside the growth. And number two, what we saw with the drought is that that's great, but $12 billion losses from your marginalized dry lands are going to overwhelm the impact that you've got from those productive investments. So that's why I think we're turning the tide and having a different conversation now.
Great, okay. Yes, please, this gentleman, there'll be a one, two. If there's anybody in the very back, I don't want to leave you out. Yes, please.
Thank you. Justin Goldman, Pacific Forum. I wonder if you could talk about your link in DRR development to the Philippines. We've seen good progress with the Growth with Equity and Mindanao program, but then 2011, Cagayan de Oro, and then Typhoon Pablo, and especially with this year with such a focus on supporting the framework agreement, you know, how that convergence goes to country team approach. Thank you.
Okay, and there's another one. Yes. Okay. Who's next? Yes, you, sir.
Good afternoon. Gregory Brown with the U.S. Department of Transportation, and I'm in the Office of International Preparedness. You had mentioned something that is kind of near and dear to me, in that 70% of the spending is going towards emergency response, whereas 30% is going towards preparedness. So in this economy, how do you envision us being able to change that from 70-30 to maybe 50-50.
Did you all hear the question in the back? Okay, the question was about changing the balance of spending 70% of funding on emergencies and only 30% on preparedness is something more like 50-50, I think.
Yeah, the bad news on that is it's actually more like 3% on disaster preparedness. And you know, there's pieces of that equation that are left out. I was just pulling out an emergency response should I answer this one?
Sure.
So how can we change that equation? I think we have the growing momentum coming out of the dialogues in places like Sendai with the Japanese and the Hurricane Sandy events, bringing it home. So this doesn't feel so much like an issue that's happening out there that we don't understand. I mean, I just say this from the perspective of U.S. policymakers and probably Japanese policymakers and New Zealand policymakers, for that matter, who also had the horrible Christchurch earthquake. I think preparedness, look, in the U.S. context, I think there's keen awareness that we need to put more investment into our infrastructure and our transportation systems that are so easily overwhelmed. I mean, we shut down for, like, a heavy rain not too long ago here in Washington, D.C., right? As a Minnesotan, I'm appalled, but okay. So I think that it's just continuing to put the evidence basis on the table. And when you put the evidence on the table, it becomes very compelling. And I won't say it again, but I'll say it one more time. Mm-hmm. I think resilience gives us a way to make it a more immediate idea. There's something about DRR mm-hmm. as a label that, I don't think it just captures imagination, and sometimes it's about how you put the ideas out there.
Okay. You want to say anything about DRR and resilience in the Philippines?
Oh, absolutely. Our country team has as one of its core strategic objectives building resilience in the Philippines, understanding how buffeted that island nation is by continual shocks. So I think I may have left it out, but as we look ahead to our work plan within AID for resilience in the year ahead has two main pieces. One is building resilience in fragile states, and the second is really a focus on Asia. And that's singling out Nepal, the area in Southeast Asia, and the Philippines as places where we want to bring that kind of focused joint planning between relief and development, pulling forward climate change adaptation and disaster risk reduction.
And we'll talk more about that in our afternoon sessions. Other questions for Nancy Lindberg? Yes, well, okay. All right. We'll take these two up here, and then we'll...
They're warming up for their panel.
Yeah.
I'm Randy Martin from Mercy Corps. Real simple question. What is the role of NGOs in resilience?
Okay, and Jim Gannon?
Jim Gannon with JCIE, and I'm going to have a similar question here, but I hear you talk about the resilience approach, and all I can think of is the human security concept that Japan has been pushing for 15 years, and you name-checked Madam Ogata, the head of JICA, former head, and the grandmother of that. And so there had been, you go back 20 years or so, there was a lot of cooperation between JICA and USAID. Now I think it's mostly on global health, and it seems to be at a lower pace. But as you move to a resilience approach, is there room for greater cooperation, joint efforts with JICA? What do you see going forward, and what are the obstacles to that? And as well as other ODA agencies. Thank you.
Great. Both good questions. And, truth in advertising from my, Randy is an old colleague, and when I was still with Mercy Corps, there was a lot of focus put on building partnerships and relationships with Japan. I had excellent meetings when I was in Tokyo last fall with our friends and colleagues at both JICA and Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And I think that where we find areas of important cooperation is particularly on thought leadership and on joining together as the donors, as part of the donor community, on driving this agenda forward. And, I started by invoking Madam Ogata in 1996. She also re-energized what is now the Resilience Dialogues at mm-hmm. the Bank. Was that 2 years ago?
Right. Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, and that's now become, a pretty important feature of the bank spring and fall meetings, is that there's a resilience dialogue, and JICA and USAID are, along with our EU and World Bank colleagues, co-host that. I think Japan has and remains a really important leader on these issues, certainly with their championship of the Hyogo Framework. It's a combination of looking very specifically at some opportunities around thought leadership, working very closely as development partners on keeping this agenda in the spotlight. And then on the role of civil society, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a huge believer in the importance of governments partnering with civil society and businesses. And civil society, both as, you know, NGOs going to other countries or civil societies in their own countries, are a huge part of the solution set. And we at AID work very closely with both. And we know that a lot of community preparedness is driven by local civil society. With the way in which you see communities as the first responders and the ways in which civil society is a critical part of creating that organization. So OFTA and our Food for Peace offices work very closely with both local and international civil society on this and other key issues.
Okay, any final question? Yes, last question here.
Since you're talking about disaster relief and resilience, I had a very funny
thought. Could you please stand
that,
up and introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Samar Chatterjee from SAFE Foundation. I had a funny feeling that next time the United States is planning to invade a country, it must develop first resilience in that country, because that's very important. So how would you go about doing that, since resilience is such an important? And the second part of the question is, could you give us some figures from USAID's expenditure, how much money you spent assisting natural disasters like Sendai, vis-a-vis how much money you spent in the wars of Iraq and Afghanistan, which are man-made disasters?
You might want to pick and choose which aspects of that question you'd like the response to.
No, I appreciate the place that the questioner is coming from. I don't have that data. But what I will say is that a significant amount of our OFTA budget goes for enduring complex crises in places like the DRC, South Sudan, the Horn of Africa, the Sahel. I mean, these places where you have that convergence of poor or missing government with extreme poverty, with continued conflict, does eat up a significant amount of our budget. It's on our website as with our commitment to transparent government. There's a dashboard, a foreign assistance dashboard, that anybody can go and see exactly how much funding goes to any particular country for any type of assistance. So please go there.
Listen, Nancy, I want to thank you very much for joining us and for